Good evening, I'm Chad O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Before the war on terrorism, there was, and is, the war on drugs, more closely linked than we might think. For example, Afghanistan is the world's largest producer of the opium poppy, the basis for heroin, and Osama bin Laden and his crew have been named by British Prime Minister Tony Blair as the source of 70% of the heroin sold on the streets of London. Another country, Colombia, accounts for more cocaine than any other, and substantial amounts of heroin as well. And the war on drugs itself consumes $20 billion each year at the federal level alone. Tonight we'll hear from two key speakers at the recent Boston University conference on our counter-narcotics strategy and how it impacts Colombia. Our first speaker is Georgetown University professor Michael Shifter, Vice President for Policy at Inter-American Dialogue, a center that focuses on Latin America. Professor Shifter replaces former drug czar Barry McCaffrey, who was originally scheduled to speak. Professor Shifter will be followed by Mark Kleiman, who directs the Program for Drug Policy Analysis at UCLA. Here now is Professor Michael Shifter.
Thank you very much, Andy, and thank you, Scott, for the invitation to be here this evening and talk a little bit about the evolution of U.S. counter-narcotics strategy. I don't pretend to speak for Barry McCaffrey. I guess I was selected to fill in because of my strong West Point background and my physical condition and the like. But I will do my best to set out sort of what I see as sort of the principal elements of U.S. counter-narcotics policy, and a large part of that will be focused on will be on Colombia, which will lead us into really tomorrow's discussion, because Colombia has, to a great extent, become almost a proxy for at least one element, one aspect of U.S. counter-narcotics strategy. The U.S. strategy clearly, and this is something that certainly U.S. policy officials like to underscore, that it has different dimensions, different elements to it. There is a concern about, on the domestic side, in dealing with the high levels of consumption and demand for drugs in the United States, and there's an important component in attacking the supply and going to the source of where the drugs are actually produced. There has been shifting levels of resources that go to those two different areas. And, of course, within both of those, there are different types of activities or different types of programs that are supported. Within the domestic side and dealing with consumption, there are resources that go to efforts at law enforcement, and there are also major resources that go to areas of education and treatment prevention. And on the supply side as well, there are areas, there's resources that go to dealing with fumigation, eradication, which is the central component on the Colombia policy, but also alternative development, interdiction, and other elements as well. This strategy, if one sort of looks over the last several decades, again, the proportion or share of resources that have gone to these different aspects has changed somewhat. In the last couple of years, there's been a decline. The proportion had been overwhelmingly about two-thirds towards the supply side and one-third on the demand side. That has changed somewhat over the last couple of years, although on the demand side, within the demand focus and framework, a lot of that, those resources have gone to law enforcement, to strengthening law enforcement efforts over the last couple of years. It's also important to talk about, when we talk about U.S. counter-narcotics strategy, what the U.S. is, because the U.S., there are so many agencies and so many congressional committees that deal with different aspects of counter-narcotics policy, of the drug policy, that when one talks about the United States, you don't know whether you're talking about Congress, talking about the administration, different agencies in the U.S. government and the like. There are very few issues, I think, where there's such a multiplicity and complexity of important actors. As I said, the United States, for its supply focus of its policy, has really concentrated principally on drug policy towards Colombia. Colombia supplies 90% of the cocaine that's consumed here in the United States and about two-thirds of all the heroin. The Colombia policy has become, again, a proxy for U.S. drug policy in trying to attack the production and trafficking of drugs at their source. This, of course, goes to the heart of a very strong domestic concern. There are roughly 52,000 Americans that die each year because of drugs, and the estimates on the economic side are about $110 billion dollars that are due to accidents and property damage and like, which are the costs to the United States. So this is an extremely important issue that has domestic resonance and has important foreign policy implications. There's probably no country in the world where, from the end of the Cold War to the new war now against terrorism, where the principal focus has been so concentrated on drugs as it was towards Colombia. During a period of the mid-1990s, from 1994 to 1998, there was a government of Ernesto Samper, who was accused of having accepted some $6 million in drug money for his campaign in 1994. As a result of that, the United States revoked the visa of the Colombian president and also 1996 and 1997 decertified Colombia, which meant that they were subject to sanctions. Decertification is one of the key elements of U.S. counter-narcotic strategy. It's been in place since 1986. Every year there's an annual review to see to what extent countries are cooperating with the United States in the fight against drugs. However, during that period, even though there was a very punitive posture and approach towards the Colombian government at the executive level, again, there was a very strong relationship between Colombian police, the National Narcotics Police, which had a close relationship with the U.S. Congress. And in fact, during the period in which there was, which Colombia was practically a pariah because of the connections or the alleged connections of its president to the Cali drug cartel, Colombia became the third largest recipient of U.S. security assistance in the world. $289 million by 1998. This money, the purpose of this money, again, went to the National Anti-Narcotics Police, and it was really aimed at the purpose of eradicating coca production, which had skyrocketed in Colombia during the 1990s, the mid-1990s. And that was the principal purpose of the aid. In 1998, things change with the government that's now in place in Colombia, of Andrés Pastrana, who, again, begins to have a wider relationship and reengage with the international community and with the United States. And the kind of mistrust of the military, which was seen as an actor that was corrupt, that was not committed to dealing and attacking drugs seriously, now becomes a major recipient of U.S. aid and a major actor in the Pastrana administration, in the current administration. What happens is a shift in U.S. policy and a much higher level of support that eventually results in what's now called the Plan Colombia. The rationale or the argument that was advanced for this shift in policy was because the situation in Colombia itself had deteriorated so much in terms of the violence and security that was it important to involve the military to secure the areas in the country that would enable the police to do its job and eradicate COCA, which was the central, again, central focus and central element of U.S. policy towards that country. In the summer of 1999, General McCaffrey himself, I think, played a very, very important role in really calling attention to the deterioration in Colombia, and he, after a trip there, came back and talked about a national emergency in Colombia, pointing to the tremendous growth in coca production and also the increase in violence and insecurity and lawlessness throughout the country. That, in fact, set in motion a process in the administration to try to come up with a strategy, a plan, approach to really try to stop what was seen as a tremendous sort of downward spiral in terms of drug production and the violence that accompanied it. The groups that were engaged in the violence were largely seen as benefiting and being fueled by the drugs. This is something that has been noted for the last decade or so, but certainly has been increasingly accepted as a central dynamic of how this process has been unfolding. In September of 1999, Plan Colombia itself was devised, was developed, and again, the focus of this was really to go after the drug production in Colombia and eradicate the coca production in southern Colombia. That was the central thrust of the aid. It was $1.3 billion. That was eventually approved and signed by President Clinton in July of 1999. Again, the rationale of this was to train anti-narcotics battalions and three anti-narcotics battalions, and also to send helicopters in order to eradicate the coca in the southern part of the country. The administration argued that, to a large extent, this strategy would work because it had succeeded in neighboring countries of Peru and Bolivia. And that, therefore, they pointed to success in neighboring countries to show that, in fact, that eradication could work and that Bolivia and Peru, in fact, had cut their production of coca substantially over the 1990s. And the administration argued that, in fact, the same would happen in the case of Colombia. Of course, the Colombian production, the production has shifted to Colombia. The administration argued that this, in fact, was a way to attack that. The new focus now that's currently being debated, and this was again approved in July of 2000 and started to be implemented in December of 2000. The new package, the new focus that began with the Clinton administration and now has been adopted and advanced by the Bush administration is called the Andean Regional Initiative. And this attempts to be more balanced in several respects than the original Plan Colombia in its strategy. So this marks an evolution as well in counter-narcotics strategy, an attempt to be more balanced, again, focusing on the supply side, but in two respects. One, to give more money not only to Colombia, but to neighboring countries, acknowledging that the problems in Colombia in terms of drug production, in terms of associated violence, refugees, and the like, have spilled over into other countries and have affected Ecuador, Venezuela, Peru, Panama, Brazil, and Bolivia, and that, therefore, the United States really should give much more attention to helping those countries deal more effectively with the spillover and the consequences, negative consequences of their policy. So there's a higher proportion, roughly half of the money that's now in the process of being debated in the U.S. Congress would go to Colombia, and the other half would be divided among the other countries. And the second aspect in which there's an attempt to achieve greater balance is that instead of focusing, which Plan Colombia did, or roughly 80% of it was on military, including training for anti-narcotics brigades and provision of helicopters, here there's an attempt to try to be more balanced in terms of military, non-military. So roughly half of this proposal would go towards military support, and the other half would go towards alternative development, institution building, and the like. Again, it's important to underscore that both programs are essentially focused on drugs. They are counter-narcotics programs. They are counter-narcotics policies. There's a different division of resources and priorities, but basically there's a continuity in the sense of counter-narcotic of the focus on drugs. At the same time, on the supply side in the region, the United States had a base in Panama that was closed in December of 1999, and therefore there was the creation of several what are called forward operating locations, areas that could be used, again, for counter-drug flights and for the Andean countries and for many of the concerns related to Colombia. There was one in Manta on the coast of Ecuador. I think the important aspect or the important question to ask in relation to certainly the way this policy that's been implemented in the region and particularly in Colombia is really what is the scenario from the U.S. government's point of view that it really expects this policy to achieve. What's going to be the result of it? The clearest articulation and formulation of U.S. the rationale was really made a week ago, just a week ago today, by the U.S. ambassador in Colombia at a conference in Cartagena, Colombia, where she talked about, again, in the context of the post-September 11th incident, which I think, of course, shapes where counter-narcotics policy may be going now. So we're at a moment, I think, of real definition and decision. But she said, and I quote from her speech a week ago today, Plan Colombia is still the most effective anti-terrorism strategy we could design and develop. And Plan Colombia will take away from the guerrillas and the self-defense, the paramilitary groups, the drug resources that they rely on. Again, the underlying premise of the policy is that once these groups are weakened, they can be attacked and defeated by more military means. She continued that the cornerstone of Plan Colombia is eradication, which is going well. This year alone, 75,000 hectares of coca have been destroyed by the anti-narcotics police in Colombia, which is double the amount that was destroyed a year ago. Colombia and U.S. policy has generated a lot of controversy. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, Professor Kleiman, I'm sure, and Professor in the question and answer session. But there is, I think, important to say, a strong commitment on the part of the administration to continue to increase resources and to try to channel it towards these activities. By May of 2001, there was the third anti-narcotics battalion that was trained in Colombia, some 2,250 members of those brigades. The U.S. claims that roughly 100 tons of coca will not arrive to the streets of the United States and Europe as a result of these efforts. There is a lot of debate and a lot of questions about what counter-narcotics policy, what direction it will go in the new context. Some people arguing that this could be, in fact, joined with a focus on counterterrorism that's currently underway in Washington. Others arguing that this may, in fact, divert resources from the drug counter-drug policy and would become a new focus of policy attention, and therefore you'll see a lessening on the anti-drug side. That, I think, is still being debated and discussed in Washington and elsewhere, and it'll be important to see how that turns out. Anyway, I'll leave it there and then be happy to respond to any questions you might have. Thank you.
That was Michael Shifter standing in for former drug czar Barry McCaffrey with an overview of the last 10 years' drug war. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. And we now hear from Mark Kleiman, who will examine the arguments for continuing the present policy as it relates to Colombia and offer an alternative of his own. Professor Kleiman is director of the Drug Policy Analysis Program at UCLA and teaches policy studies there. Professor Kleiman.
Thank you very much. Thank all of you for coming out. It's an honor to be asked to help kick off such a distinguished meeting. And everyone here knows more than I do about Colombia. So accordingly, I'm not going to talk about Colombia. Other than in passing, my theme is drugs and foreign policy. So I want to start by stating what I take to be the argument for moving drug suppression up, drug suppression in source and transit countries, up our foreign policy priority list. Then I want to try to convince you that that argument for paying more attention to drug suppression in source and transit countries doesn't hold water. Now, that would be a very hard job if I were on a TV talk show or testifying in front of a congressional committee. In this forum, it may be a somewhat easier job. But having made that argument, I want to do something that may be more surprising. I want to argue that American domestic drug policy can and should, but currently does not, serve our foreign policy goals and improve the welfare of people in other countries. That by reducing domestic consumption of foreign-sourced drugs, we can make life better in Colombia and perhaps make financing international terrorism a little bit harder. Not a lot harder, but a little bit. And since that bare claim is unconvincing in the absence of some idea of how it might be done, I want to explain in some detail how I think we can do it. By using the power of probation and parole supervision to force down heroin and cocaine consumption among the heaviest users of those drugs. The widespread notion that America's drug problem consists of employed wealthy people snorting cocaine on Saturday night simply doesn't stand up to simple arithmetic. The bulk of our drug consumption goes to people who are heavy users and also offenders. So if we could squeeze down on their consumption, we could make a big difference. All right, so much for the roadmap. Now back to the top. The argument for paying more attention to drug policy in our foreign policy goes something like this. Cocaine and heroin are the two largest in dollar volume illicit drug markets in the U.S. Both drugs do enormous damage, though I should note nothing like 50,000 dead and $110 billion in economic damage. Those are, I think, largely fantasy numbers. Still, they do enormous damage, generate a lot of misery among addicts, among their families, among their neighbors, a lot of crime, a lot of disease. All supplies of heroin and cocaine come from overseas sources. The United States grows effectively no coca, no opium poppy, and does effectively no illicit refining of heroin and cocaine. If we get heroin and cocaine, it comes from abroad. The traffic into the U.S. is dominated by foreign-based organizations. Therefore, the argument goes, the most direct way to solve our cocaine and heroin problems is to stop them at the source. Somebody once said to me, look, if we were being invaded by a foreign army, we'd send the military to stop it. Why is this any different? If it is said we could only get overseas farmers to stop producing coca and poppy, foreign-based trafficking organizations to stop shipping them here, and foreign governments to stop fooling around and do their bit in enforcing their own drug laws and the international treaties they've signed. If we could do that, it is said, we could substantially reduce the extent to which Americans abuse cocaine and heroin, and therefore the damage those drugs do to American society. All right, that's the argument. On this account, we continue to have a big drug problem, in substantial part because overseas governments have failed to do their job. Now, on this analysis, those governments are either simply incapable of reducing drug exports to the U.S. because of, one, weak control over the areas where the drug crops grow, or the refining and export is carried out, or, two, because intimidation or corruption of enforcement officials is so pervasive that the governments cannot make their own cops, judges, and soldiers do their duties, or, three, those governments lack the political will to get the job done because drug traffic serves important constituencies. They're important constituencies to them, ranging from peasants who rely on drug crops for otherwise scarce cash income to large-scale traffickers who make campaign contributions or otherwise influence politics. Right? So that's the story. In this story, the U.S. needs to push the drug issue up the diplomatic priority list, making it clear to foreign governments that good things like trade and aid will happen and bad things like desertification and sanctions won't happen if they clean up their act. Right? To make the outcomes that matter to the leadership of foreign governments strongly dependent on whether they do their bit in solving our mutual drug problem. And the argument is there's mutual benefit in our helping other countries improve their domestic capacities for enforcement and adjudication. The slogan is strengthening the rule of law. All this overseas activity is supposed to ameliorate our domestic drug problem because the drugs don't come from here. And they usually come from or through a small number of source and transit countries. So for Colombia, for cocaine currently, produced in Colombia, from coca grown either in Colombia or Bolivia or Peru, via Mexico and the Caribbean. That's where it comes. For heroin, it's again largely Colombia, via Mexico and the Caribbean, and Southeast Asia, basically Burma, Laos, Thailand, and to a small extent, Southwest Asia, Afghanistan and Pakistan, for heroin. That's where we get our drugs. Now, an obvious objection. Right, so that's the story. Now I want to sort of tell you why it's not true. An obvious objection to the story, but one that I won't push because I don't think it's right, is that we can and do produce some of our own illicit drugs, and that domestic production will rise as foreign importation and production are made harder. Now, the obvious case here is cannabis. We used to get our cannabis from Mexico. We did Operation Interdiction at the border in about 1970, thus generating the Colombian cannabis trade into the U.S., which slowly morphed into the Colombian cocaine trade into the U.S. And then we made smuggling cannabis from Colombia harder with the South Florida Task Force. And as a result of all of that, America started growing its own pot. Domestic production went from about 10%, less than 10%, to probably more than 50% by value of the total cannabis consumed in the U.S., right? American ingenuity rose to meet the challenge of the cannabis shortage. Some of us regarded marijuana interdiction as the most successful attempt ever made to protect American producers from unfair foreign competition. This also led to the memorable comment of a Mexican politician about the certification process. He said, why don't you decertify Oregon? Which was a fair question. However, cannabis is a special case because it's extraordinarily bulky. The value of cannabis per kilogram for the stuff we import is about a fifth to a tenth of the value per kilogram of cocaine. So if you're a smuggler, cocaine is a much easier problem, and heroin is three or four times easier than that. And so what worked for cannabis won't clearly work for heroin or cocaine. If we had to be self-sufficient in illicit drugs, prices would be much higher and availability much lower. Americans provide expensive labor. Americans don't like to go to prison. And American drug law enforcement is both vigorous and astonishingly resistant to bribery, political pressure, or physical intimidation. It may not be a good thing. I think we overdo it. But we enforce our drug laws here. Lest we forget, we've got about 500,000 Americans behind bars at any one time for violating the drug laws. It's not easy. I'm not saying that there isn't some deputy sheriff somewhere in Georgia who doesn't accept a wad full of cash to look the other way when the plane lands. But the notion that you could systematically corrupt your way out of domestic U.S. law enforcement is foolish. This isn't prohibition. This is a different story. However, even though it's the case that if we got no drugs from abroad, our drug problem would be noticeably less, I don't think the strategy of trying to solve our drug problem somewhere else will work, because I don't think there's any way we can stop the drugs from coming in. And that's true because of three factors that apply to all markets, but in particular they apply to the illicit markets: replacement, substitution, and adaptation, and to two special facts about the drug markets, which is drugs are cheap and they grow anywhere. All right, first point, replacement. We heard in the account of the strategy behind Plan Colombia, well, we eradicated 100 tons of cocaine's worth of coca leaf. That's 100 tons that doesn't get to our domestic market. False. What determines the amount of cocaine consumed in the U.S. is the intersection between the supply and demand curve for cocaine in the U.S. As long as there are retail dealers and customers with money, somebody at some price is going to deliver the bulk drugs. And then the only question is, well, how much can you force the price up? So when we hear about how much of the cocaine has been destroyed on the ground or seized after production, don't let that fool you into thinking that that's somehow been prevented from being used here. All right, point two is substitution. Colombia is now very important to us for cocaine and for heroin, but it wasn't always, and it may not be so in the future. Right, in 1980, we had a rip-roaring, or I think, let me take it further back, 1970, we had a rip-roaring heroin problem here, none of it from Colombia. Right, Colombia started to produce poppy when it occurred to the cocaine traffickers, well, look, as long as we're sending the boat, as long as we've got the connections, we might as well branch out into a new line. But there's nothing special about Colombia. Colombia is not a particularly good place to grow coca. Coca grows best in the highlands, not in the lowlands. Between the wars, we got all of our pharmaceutical cocaine from Java. Right? So this notion that E-coca is a plant with a restricted range, he is a product of historical myopia. Same thing's true of drug trafficking organizations. The Arellano Felix brothers in Mexico run the largest transshipment organization. They probably are responsible for more illicit drug, both heroin and cocaine, getting into the U.S. than anybody else. But 15 years ago, nobody had ever heard of them. And I'm prepared to predict that 5 years from now, nobody will have heard of them again. And it won't have changed anything. The drugs are replaceable. The organizations are replaceable. The trade routes are replaceable. The third factor of this business is adaptation. It's possible to impose costs on any particular style of drug production and trafficking. Right? If the air bridge from Peru to Colombia is important, well, we can shut it down. We can make it very expensive to move coca and cocaine across that air bridge. And that will indeed move the production of coca from Peru to Colombia. It won't eliminate the production of cocaine, right? This is not like damming a river. This is an offense-defense game. We are dealing not with a force of nature, but with intelligent human beings who are trying to get their business done at minimal cost. And therefore, they will adapt their operations in ways that minimize the cost to them of getting around whatever enforcement we put up. Jack Lawn, when he was administrator of DEA in the 1980s, trying to explain to the Congress why interdiction wasn't the answer to all of our drug problems, said, "Senator, if we built a 50-foot wall around the United States, the traffickers would build 51-foot ladders." That seems to me one of the most important things ever said about this.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. We're looking at America's war on drugs.
Now the two empirical facts, which could have been otherwise but aren't. Raw drugs are cheap. The cost of the leaf, the coca leaf, that goes into cocaine, or the opium that goes into heroin, is less than 1% of the retail price. So if we doubled the cost of coca leaf or doubled the cost of opium, we couldn't measure the impact on the price of heroin and cocaine. Right? So not only can this stuff be replaced, it's replaceable cheaply. And that's what makes it so implausible that we could bring about a shortage for more than the time it takes somebody to plant a new crop. But just knocking off a few thousands or tens of thousands of hectares of plants at a time gets us virtually nowhere. Second, drugs can be stored. It's a little bit more true of opium than it is of cocaine, because the leaf doesn't really store very well. But refined cocaine stores quite nicely, thank you, and opium stores forever. Opium is a traditional store of wealth in places where it's traditionally grown. And since they can be stored, a rational trafficker will keep inventory. And that inventory buffers the possibility of supply interruption. Imagine you're a farmer in Colombia and you grow coca for some refiner. You have to decide how much to grow and how much to keep on hand. If you grow a little too much, well, you wasted your labor and you've got to compost the leaves. If you grow not quite enough, not only do you lose the cash sale, but your customer may seek out another supplier. So in business school terms, the oversupply cost, the overstock cost is low, and the stockout cost is high. That means that the rational thing to do is to grow or store more than you think you can sell. And I don't see any reason to think that people don't do exactly that calculation. Now again, cannabis was different because of the bulk. And as a result, the increase in drug enforcement over the last two decades has driven cannabis prices to pretty high levels. I am old enough, I'm embarrassed to say, to remember $25 an ounce cannabis. Current price is something like $300. Now, that's not as spectacular as it seems. You've got about a factor of 4 inflation in there and about a factor of 3 increase in potency. Still, the price of cannabis is higher than it was when we started the big push. In 1980, the price of heroin on the streets of the U.S. was $2.50, $1980, a pure milligram. It's now $1. So that's adjusting for inflation, about an 80% decrease. In 1980, the price of cocaine retail was $800 a pure gram. It's now $100 a pure gram. So that's more than 80% decrease, ignoring inflation. So even a big burst of domestic enforcement activity where the costs are high hasn't managed to drive prices up or availabilities down. So that's why I'm convinced that overseas activities won't do much, if anything, to reduce the size of our domestic drug problems. Well, but some people say, anti-drug crusading is like chicken soup. It couldn't hurt. Wrong. Wrong. First, since outside of Lake Wobegon, not everything can be a priority. If we move drugs up the list, we've got to move something else down the list. That could be democracy, trade, human rights, support for U.S. positions, international fora, anti-terrorism. Take your pick. If drugs is more important relatively, then something else has to be less important relatively. Now, I should quickly add, it might be the case that counter-drug cooperation is a good way to get friendly with people we otherwise don't have much in common with. And having done that, having created trust, we can then expand that out and work on with those same governments on other topics that matter to us. The theory is, well, since illicit drugs are widely unpopular, we might agree about that with governments about whom we agree with almost nothing else. And that argument was made about the Taliban, and it's made for the SLORC in Burma, which I refuse to call Myanmar. And I will defer to the foreign policy experts here about how plausible that is. I think most of the people in the government who backed the aid to the Taliban, which we gave them last spring in return for eradicating their poppy crop, are a little embarrassed now. Now, it might also be the case that we have an interest in maintaining the stability of these governments. They need our help against cocaine trafficking or against heroin trafficking in order to maintain their own stability, right? That's the Plan Colombia story. And again, I want to defer to Colombian experts about how plausible a story that is. And the same story might be told about strengthening the rule of law. It's possible that the side benefits more than pay for the costs, and that the drug benefit, if there is any, is thrown in as an extra. Okay, and again, what I want to say about all of those, I know, ask the experts. If those are good reasons to do this, then there's a good reason to do it. But that's different from the claim that we can solve our drug problem in Colombia. We can't. So I hope by now to have convinced you that that claim, that our foreign policy can and should serve our domestic anti-drug policy, just doesn't hold water. It's our drug problem. We got to deal with it here. And I should note, in addition to the opportunity cost of our drug efforts, there are some direct costs. Our anti-drug efforts, just like drug trafficking, can destabilize governments in which we have a stake. Again, I don't hold myself out as an expert on Colombian politics, but if I think about myself in the position of one of the leaders of the FARC, I have to imagine that the spectacle of the DEA accusing President Samper of taking money from drug dealers must have been a cheering sight. If you were trying to bring down the Colombian government, that must have been good news. Our anti-drug stuff can also lead us to provide resources to unsavory regimes, the Taliban, the SLORC, Fujimori, or, and this is a slightly different point, supporting elements in foreign political processes that are particularly hostile to democracy and human rights. Montesinos, a clear example. So is the KGB. People forget that in the aftermath of the fall of the wall, then Attorney General Thornburg traveled to Moscow and met with the head of what I think was still then called the KGB and announced that there was going to be cooperation between the FBI and the KGB in suppressing Russia's quite severe drug problems. So I'm not saying it was a bad idea, just pointing out, look, that's got costs. When the Attorney General helps the KGB in the midst of its power struggle with everybody else in Russia, that's got costs for us. And, of course, anti-drug policy can also generate tensions with friends. when General McCaffrey went to the Netherlands and announced that their homicide rate was twice ours because of their horrible drug policies. That led to some amusement because their homicide rate is actually a fifth of ours, and some annoyance. The ratio of annoyance to amusement is higher in Mexico. Okay, so much for the negative part of my talk. Let me give you the good news. Effective domestic drug policy can serve overseas gold. Right, this is the famous demand side. But I want to argue that the supply and demand concept has been severely misapplied in the drug policy area. People tend to think of supply side as meaning enforcement. Right, so supply side is coercive, and the demand side is prevention and treatment. So the demand side is facilitative. Right, so supply side is Republican and demand side is Democratic. Right, supply side is mean, demand side is nice. And a lot of the politics of drug policy polarizes around that. Hawks versus doves in the war on drugs. Well, that's just silly. There are lots of coercive things you can do on the demand side. There are lots of facilitated things you can do on the supply side. We started going out to the junior high schools in neighborhoods where a lot of the kids wind up getting involved in drug trafficking when they get a little bit older, and doing prevention efforts aimed at drug trafficking rather than drug consumption, right? We spend no effort in this country trying to persuade kids not to deal drugs. But we spend a lot of effort trying to persuade them not to use drugs. Well, that would be a facilitative effort on the supply side of the market. More to the point, we can use coercion on the demand side. It's obvious in the case when we arrest users, but everybody knows that arresting users is pretty much a waste of time. People think about the demand side in terms of prevention, whose effectiveness is very low, though its cost effectiveness is high because it's cheap. You just can't do much of it usefully. Treatment, which is limited both by our capacity and by the interest of active drug addicts in getting treatment, which is less than you might think. Drug courts, which is limited because they manage a tiny number of people. The one thing we don't do much of, and the one thing that would work, is using probation and parole supervision. 80% of heroin and cocaine is used by heavy users, not light users. That's not because being a heavy user is common. It's actually pretty uncommon. Being an addicted cocaine user, given that you're a cocaine user, is about as common as being an alcoholic, given that you drink alcohol at all. This is a statistically predictable but somewhat rare consequence of the use of any of these drugs. About 15% of cocaine users wind up as heavy cocaine users. About probably 25 or 30% of heroin users even wind up as heavy heroin users. But they account for almost all the volume, because it doesn't matter how many Saturday night users they have. They don't use any substantial amount. Of the heavy users of heroin and cocaine, three-quarters get arrested in the course of any given year. It's not easy to maintain a $15,000 after-tax drug habit with the amount of money that people in the neighborhoods where most of the addicts come from live without doing something you get arrested for. So, if my arithmetic serves me, 75% of 80% is 60%. 60% of the heroin and cocaine sold in this country is sold to people who were arrested this year, whose names we literally know, and who, if they're not in prison, probably on probation or parole. We do next to nothing to get them to stop using drugs. In Los Angeles County, where I come from, where I'm living now, and where I'm currently doing a study, there are 100,000 felons, adult felons, on probation. The LA County Probation Department administered 100,000 drug tests last year. Right? That's one test per probationer per year. Since the detection window for heroin and cocaine is about 72 hours. That means that a probationer using cocaine has about one chance in 100 of getting caught. So, not rocket science, twice a week drug testing, immediate, automatic, formulaic sanctions, not severe, 20 hours community service, 48 hours locked up, that's all you need, but reliable for every instance of drug use or for every missed test. Turns out if you're on probation, the smart thing to do is simply, and you've been using, the smart thing to do is simply not show up for your scheduled drug test. If we did that, we could shrink our heroin and cocaine demand by about 40%. It's 40% less exports. That would matter to Colombia. A lot. Reducing U.S. heroin demand would matter almost not at all to Afghanistan. I see Speaker Hastert has called for stepping up domestic drug enforcement in order to starve Al-Qaeda of the revenues it gets from the poppy trade. Well, we get about 4% of our heroin from Afghani poppy. Right? We're just not a player in that market. Okay, conclusions. Our foreign policy ought to serve foreign policy and security goals, including democratization, development, human rights, defending ourselves against terrorism. So, if Plan Colombia is good for Colombia, if the Andean Initiative is good for the Andean region, more power to them. But our drug problem has to be solved here. And if we did things that we know how to do to solve it here, we could contribute less to the drug problems of the countries that supply us. Thanks.
UCLA Professor of Policy Studies Mark Kleiman. You've been listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Special thanks to Professor Andrew Vasevich of the Boston University Department of International Relations for his assistance with this program. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287 and join the conversation at buwi.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Keith Infantino and Chris Bannon. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.
This is WBUR Ball.